Good evening, everyone. You're in the right place at the right time. This is Coast to Coast AM, blasting out of the Mojave Desert like a Scirocco, blazing across the land, into your town, into your home, slamming into your radio like a supercharged nanoparticle of unobtainium. Greetings from the boldest, bawdiest, most outrageous city in the world, the planetary capital of sun, fun, sin, sex, and secrets, my not-so-humble hometown, Las Vegas, Nevada. My name is George Knapp, your occasional host, your designated driver of the airwaves, and moderator of tonight's upcoming cacophony of conversation. Glad to be back with you once again. Boy, do we have a power-packed presentation for your listening pleasure this evening. This might be the most intense concentration of raw brain power ever assembled for a single coast-to-coast program, at least since I've been hosting. But these folks are not indecipherable eggheads here to speak down to the unwashed masses, and by that I mean me. Coming up for the first 2 hours tonight, looking at the high-minded, supremely complicated, but also elegantly simplistic view of reality made possible by quantum theory. You've all heard the old teaser question, if a tree fell in the forest and there was no one around to hear it, would it make a sound? It's a philosophical question in some ways, but also a scientific one. Quantum theory has its own answer, one that, on the surface anyway, would seem to inherently conflict with Einstein's relativity theory of the universe, his speed limit. But it doesn't. Is it possible, for instance, to use quantum mechanics to know the mind of God, to fashion your own reality, your own version of the universe? Is the universe here only because we're here to perceive it and to interact with it? Heady stuff to consider. There is an absolutely wonderful new book by a gifted MIT professor named Dr. David Kaiser that focuses on these kinds of questions, questions that are central to human existence. And it does so using some very interesting characters as the vehicles for telling the story of all things quantum. Dr. Kaiser's book is called How the Hippies Saved Physics. It's earning rave reviews as one of the best nonfiction books of the year. I read it this weekend. I agree wholeheartedly. And as you might expect, with a title like that, it's also stirred up a bit of ire in some scientific circles. What? Someone saved physics? Saved it from what? How was it saved? And who the heck are these hippies who supposedly pulled this off? A few of these so-called hippies from the title, and I'm using invisible quotation marks around the word hippies. Two of the hippies are already known to Coast listeners. They are both brilliant, some would say eccentric, certainly colorful, and opinionated physicists whose primary interest in all things quantum led them to explore consciousness, the nature of reality itself, mind expansion techniques, ESP, remote viewing, and a host of other disciplines that drive mainstream science crazy, but which have paved the way for a better understanding of our world. Joining me and Dr. David Kaiser will be Dr. Fred Allen Wolf and Dr. Jack Sarfati, and there is not a shrinking violet in a whole bunch. I think this is going to be a lot of fun and an exchange that could help all of us to see reality in a different light. And then, as if that's not enough, in hours 3 and 4, a first-time guest, Sue Swiatek, from the Fund for UFO Research, to speak with us about an important anniversary that begins just after midnight, one of the seminal events in modern ufology, as well as an excellent book and research project called Grassroots UFO. So when I say we're packing tonight, I really do mean it. We'll take our break. Be right back with Dr. David Kaiser and the hippies who saved physics. I'm George Knapp, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast. I'm George Knapp. As I mentioned at the top of the program, reviewers are falling all over themselves in their praise for How the Hippies Saved Physics. It is jam-packed with fascinating real-life characters, these brilliant, eccentric, wild men and women who in the late 60s through the 70s met together on a regular basis to talk about big-picture stuff, the nature of reality, quantum mechanics, mind expansion, the relationship of physics to consciousness. Toss in the likes of the CIA, some ESP, LSD, hot tubs, mud baths, long hair, counterculture mentalities, and you have an absolutely fascinating and eclectic mix of intellect and ego, meetings of the minds during one of the most interesting and tumultuous eras of modern history. Joining me now is the man who wrote the book. He teaches science, technology, and society courses within the physics department at MIT. He earned PhDs in both physics and the History of Science from Harvard. He's been featured in Science, Nature, Scientific American, and on TV's Nova, Dr. David Kaiser. Great to have you here, Dr. Kaiser.
Well, George, thanks so much. It's really a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
I would say exploring and writing about the history of science, you've got a pretty fun and unique niche there. Not a bad gig.
It's a great gig. It's a real pleasure. And I have to say, this book in particular was really just a joy every single day that I got to work on it. It was really a pleasure.
Well, it is a wonderful book. I was worried when I first read of it that it might be too far over my head or the audience's head, but it's clearly written for the layman, a general audience, as well as for the scientifically inclined. I mean, in the past, you have written about some established scientific heavyweights. How did you settle on this group and this time period?
Sure. You know, it's funny. I guess looking back, I've been dimly aware of the group for a long time. I didn't quite know the extent of it. But going back even to my own childhood, I mean, when I was a high school student, I was a great, great fan of some popular books about science, about physics. I read all I could get my hands on, and one of them that really made a mark on me was Fritjof Capra's book, The Tao of Physics, that I think probably a lot of your listeners will know, too. It's by now, nowadays, it's a mega blockbuster, you know, worldwide bestseller. I think at last count, it had 43 editions in 23 languages, you know, that kind of thing. So, of course, we've all heard of it. And, you know, when I read that book as a kid, I was really impressed by it. I was captured by it. And again, looking back, the Eastern side, the parallels that Capra saw between modern physics and things like Hinduism or Buddhism or Taoism, those links didn't quite grab me as much. But it's also, I just found a remarkably, you know, fun, good book introducing some really cool ideas for modern physics on its own, let alone the other kind of interesting ideas that Capra's playing with. And then in college, you know, I was really excited about physics. I was studying physics for my major, and I started learning a bit about a topic that I'm sure we'll talk a lot about tonight. It's nowadays called entanglement or quantum non-locality. Those are kind of fancy words, but it's one of these, you know, delicious, wonderful examples of how quantum theory just doesn't behave the way we might expect from ordinary experience. And that really kind of, I just got hooked on that in college. And then in graduate school, when I was working on my PhD on the physics side, I used to joke, it's a horrible thing. They used to force us theory students to do at least one semester of lab to keep us honest. I thought it was just the worst thing in the world. But one very good thing came out of that, which is that I was able to recreate an experiment, which was first done, as I write about in the book, by John Clauser, a remarkably ingenious, gifted experimental physicist who was the first person ever in the world to test this strange notion of quantum entanglement. And so I've been kind of bumping along, interested in these topics for a long time, and only in the course of a little more digging did I find out that people like Fritjof Capra and John Clauser, and in fact other folks, some of whom we'll be hearing, you know, from tonight, were members of this, you know, very spirited, kind of informal brainstorming group that called themselves the Fundamental Physics Group. And they met in Berkeley in the 70s every week for years and years as this really kind of, from what I can reconstruct and from talking with these folks, I think a very free-spirited but also, you know, very serious in the sense of really wanted to understand the world and press on big, deep, and great questions about quantum theory. And so, you know, from my own childhood right through my training, I had been kind of without quite realizing where it was heading, I was interested in this group and what they were working on.
Without being too selfish about the whole thing, why does any of this matter to me, to regular folks? Why should I care about quantum theory, about entanglement? I know the phrase that you use in the book and that is so famous is a spooky, what is it? How's it go? Spooky
action at a distance.
What is in it for me, for our listeners, whether we understand this or not?
Well, fair enough. That's, I don't think it's a selfish question. It's a good question. I think there are a couple ways to answer that. One is we can go right to the sort of hyper-practical. I mean, these days, surrounding me at MIT and on many, many campuses, actually not far from you out there in Las Vegas, Nevada as well, all over the country, there's a great deal of interest in putting some of these very specific ideas to work in actual engineering. So some of these ideas have now left the blackboard, left the theorists' imaginations, or not limited to those, And people are building actual prototypes for a new generation of devices that I think will just be sort of breathtaking, will change what we take for granted. So these, what do I mean by that? Things like quantum computers, which should do things exponentially quicker than our best, you know, fanciest computers now. A topic that I do write a bit about in the book, a related notion called quantum encryption or quantum cryptography, a whole new way to protect the way we send and receive information. Everyone relies on some form of encryption all the time, often without realizing it, when we send emails, when we make a purchase on the internet, and that's using what will soon be seen as very old-fashioned, very effective, but very old-fashioned encryption. And this new generation approach relies not on the practical limits of computers, how hard is it to do certain math problems to factor large numbers, that's how our current day encryption works, but in fact, encryption that relies on the very laws of nature, which is a pretty good thing you want on your side if you're trying to protect your information. And so there are things like that. Now, a multi-billion-dollar research program across government laboratories, private industry, lots and lots of university researchers around the world, in the United States and Japan, all over the place. So on the one hand, why should anyone care? I mean, within our lifetimes, and perhaps actually fairly soon, I think a lot of the kind of gadgets around us will just be taking advantage, will be built around some very, very cool ideas from quantum theory. So that's already, I think that's one kind of interesting reason to perk up one's ears. But it shouldn't, I don't think it's limited to that. And I think in the spirit of this group that I was writing about, there's a lot more to life and a lot more to physics than just gadgets or just inventions. And so I think another reason, or at least, one other reason to think about is that, some of these ideas are, for my money, the most sort of fascinating and mysterious and sometimes frustrating ideas that we've been led to in our, century quest of modern physics. And there's a kind of beauty to that. There's a kind of, I would still call it an enduring mystery. I mean, they're really just, I think, these notions themselves are, they can pull one up short, right? And so just for the sheer fun of the intellectual journey, as well as for the kind of practical spin-offs, which are soon coming online, I think those are a few good reasons to give some extra thought to things like quantum entanglement.
People forget that there is still value in knowledge for its own sake and knowing and exploring. And, you look at American universities, you work in it, you know it better than I do, but people view them now, universities, as a jobs factory. You go to a university or a college to get a degree so you can get a job, not for the sake of learning about the world around us so much. So there is a purity involved in the kind of research that the group you're describing did.
There really was, and that's, I must say, that's part of what drew me to them, was that they really were after kind of, they used to say, or the joke has often been made, physics with a capital F, and they spelled the word physics in their group with an F, fundamental physics group, and physics was spelled F-Y-S-I-K-S. Just, the point is, it's playful, it's astonishingly interesting, often very unexpected. And why shouldn't some people get to spend their time thinking about that? it has its own charm to it, and then there are these kind of wonderful surprises where things might actually become of practical use, even when that wasn't the original intention.
We're breaking Fred and Jack on in just a couple of minutes. I just want to finish up with you an overview of the book. The title, I guess, some would say it's presumptuous. I'm sure you're catching flack for it in some circles. I mean, it works. It's catchy. It grabs your eye, but my guess is that, we're not meant to take it in an absolute literal sense, as if you carve these words into Mount Rushmore, these hippies personally saved physics.
That's exactly right. And, I'm paying not a large price. It's a modest price for a catchy title. And quite frankly, it's a price I'm happy to pay. I stand by the title. And I say in the introduction of the book, just as you said, this is, the title's meant to be playful, a little bit bombastic, a little bit ironic, but not all tongue-in-cheek. I mean, as we'll see, these folks were doing some remarkable things, and they have left a legacy right to this day, a legacy that had largely been forgotten by my peers, by my colleagues in physics. But it's a real legacy. We can chase it down, thought by thought nonetheless. And so I don't think any small group of individuals any group, you know, could save a whole discipline like physics on their own. Of course not. The title's meant to be kind of over the top. But nonetheless, there's some real kind of activity and real contributions going on here that simply can't be denied, and that open up a much wider picture, when I put my historian's cap on, a much wider picture about, you know, how does science get done under any circumstances? What's the constant back and forth, the interplay between the sort of world of ideas and, you know, politics, culture, society? I mean, all the world scientists are embedded in society somehow, right? So let's take this amazing example, I think amazing, or at least a curious and unexpected example, with one of the, you know, most colorful periods in American history, the 1970s in the Bay Area, some remarkably, you know, beautiful ideas in physics like entanglement. And what comes out of that sort of heady mix? So yes, the title is meant to be suggestive and not to be, as you say, carved into Mount Rushmore.
One other question. We'll be taking a break, and then we'll bring Jack and Fred on. But describe for me that period, in science anyway, leading up to the one that's described in the book. You know, you would think that the Cold War would be glory days for physics and for physicists. You know, everybody, here's your paycheck, build some bombs, build some better bombs, crank up the war machine, money's no object, full employment for everybody, we want your ideas, but that is not the case. Give me the thumbnail sketch of what you describe as the era of shut up and calculate.
Right. I mean, that's actually where I had been working most on in my historical work, was on the height of the Cold War period, just before the 70s, really, before things take a different turn. And, you know, it was rightly seen as a golden age. A lot of scientists from that generation still look back on that as a golden age, just for the reason you said. It's like the money seemed literally unstoppable. I mean, it was with no comparison to what had come before. Spending in real terms, adjusting for inflation, on basic research, university research in physics grew by a factor of 25, not 25%. It grew times 25 between the late 30s and the mid 1950s, as they after with the sort of sea change of World War II, and then that kind of Cold War funding model that gets set in place with a pipeline of money from the Pentagon, effectively, to do just basic research, not even weapons stuff. That was always a very small minority of the people who were on the physics payroll at the time. So money was no object. You could think big, think about the world's largest atom smashers, these humongous factory-sized machines geared up to study esoteric phenomena among, you know, little parts of atoms. It was a golden age, and there was more jobs than students, even as the number of students rose like gangbusters. And so I don't want to say that picture is false. I think that picture is overlooking some trade-offs that were made, and they weren't quite noticed at the time. And the trade-off often was the money and the excitement and the certain direction for research, but a kind of narrowing of the range of topics. So it wasn't that the work done was bad. It was often great and got tons of Nobel Prizes for American physicists. It was a great time. But it was kind of winnowing. It was narrowing the range of topics and the kind of broad picture philosophical, you know, what does it all mean stuff, the stuff that had kept people like Albert Einstein and Werner Heisenberg up at night in their own day. That kind of style was really getting edged out and sometimes shoved out with that phrase that you mentioned, shut up and calculate. You know, the job of the post-war physicist was seen to be one to calculate and stick close to kind of the numbers and don't go off in that kind of earlier style about asking it about the nature of consciousness or the, you know, fate of the universe. And so so that's what I was curious about, that transition. You know, both styles have pluses and minuses, but to see the discipline pushed pretty far out of whack compared to what had come before or what would come later, that was really curious to me about that kind of 1940s and 50s and 60s era.
We're going to the break in just a second as soon as we hear the music. But what occurred to me as I'm reading the book is I wonder if all these guys would have and women would have done this stuff, would have been able to spend the time on thinking about the big picture if they hadn't been basically underemployed at the time.
Well, I think that played a large role. The group that I wrote about has this amazing set of characteristics. They are absolutely passionate about physics. I mean, as you, I'm sure you'll hear when we get Fred and Jack on, and I try to capture some of that in the book. I mean, they were just, you know, they would eat and breathe this stuff, like the best of them, and they were exceedingly well trained. I mean, they'd done PhDs at some of the world's, the nation's greatest physics departments. They weren't just sitting back in their easy chair. They knew how to calculate. They did their problem sets. They were extremely, you know, smart, and yet, right, their situation, where they found themselves professionally, was just so different from that kind of Cold War model that we were just talking about, that they literally kind of had time on their hands, and they had that thirst that had brought them into physics in the first place. They had the skills. When they had a question, they could calculate like crazy. And now they found themselves with, in a sense, you know, what else would they do anyway, right? What else would they do since they weren't going to be pursuing the kind of what had seemed like the standard career path? And I think that's that great mix that led to some pretty unexpected and exciting, you know, adventures.
I mentioned earlier the term hippies, sort of used in quotation marks. I mean, there's a range of counterculture types who could be hit with that label. You have a great quote in the book from Ronald Reagan where he says, the hippies, they dress like Tarzan, they have hair like Jane, and they smell like cheetah, which, of course, not everyone in this group, maybe no one in the group exactly fit that. Just because you have long hair and a beard doesn't mean you're a dropout and an acid head.
That's exactly right. And, you know, so I use that quote from Reagan because, first of all, it's a great quotation.
Yeah.
But also to say, just like you said, I mean, that's what passed as hippie when it was used at the time as a, you know, as a term of slander, right? That's what the enemies would call a hippie. That's not what these folks would have called themselves or how they would have thought about themselves.
Dr. David Kaiser, we'll take a break. We come back, we'll bring on Fred Alan Wolf and Jack Sarfati. Hope you're staying with us, everyone, here on Coast to Coast AM. I think you'll notice there's a sort of a Kerouacian flavor through the work of the fundamental physics group that we'll be talking to, two members of that group, two of the so-called hippies that saved physics. Doctors Fred Alan Wolf and Jack Sarfati join me and Dr. David Kaiser right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Fred Alan Wolf is a physicist, writer, and lecturer, better known by his well-earned nickname, Dr. Quantum. He's the author of 14 books, including Taking the Quantum Leap, which was the winner of the prestigious National Book Award for Science. And his most recent book is Time Loops and Space Twists, How God Created the Universe. He's been a guest on the program in the past, and he's joined also by Dr. Jack Sarfati, a physicist with a long-term interest in issues of consciousness and the paranormal, well-known to our audience as someone who does not suffer fools. His most recent book, Space, Time, and Beyond 2, the series episode, Dark Energy. Great to have you on the show, Fred and Jack. Welcome back.
Thank you very much, George. Pleasure to be on.
Hey, let's start with this way. Fred, maybe with you. Did you know back at the time that you were one of the hippies who were saving physics?
Well, I knew I had a passionate interest. I wasn't really thinking in terms of myself as being a hippie, and I'm sure Jack wouldn't think himself that way either. But we were passionate. In fact, just as I was listening to David describe his book, I was realizing that we were interested in theory. We were theoretical physicists, and theory is a very special word. It comes from the ancient Greek, meaning at first a looking at or viewing or beholding. But in the later development of Pythagorean school, it became changed. It became to mean passionate, sympathetic contemplation. And that's precisely what we were doing. We were passionate. We were sympathetic with each other's desire to grasp hold of this strange, elusive eel of understanding we call quantum physics. And we were interested in all kinds of things which went along with this new understanding in terms of our passion and our desire to fully grasp what was going on. So I wouldn't call ourselves hippies. I would just call ourselves fringe, you might call us, or marginal. It turns out that was marginal in the 70s turns out to be pretty much stayed-in-the-wool okay stuff in the 90s and in the year 2000. So whatever we were doing then seems to, I think, did spur on a lot of activity. And I think Jack's had a great influence on spurring people on. From the receptions that I've had in my books and lectures and appearance in movies and whatever, and the kinds of emails I get, people are really passionate about understanding why they're here, what's the nature of reality, why is there a mind to contemplate that there's a nature of reality in the first place. So all these really deep, passionate, sympathetic contemplations, I believe, It's important to share those. I believe that it's important that people, ordinary folk, people that don't necessarily understand the scientific principles at the deepest level, which I don't think even we do yet, it's necessary to share the passion, to share the desire, share the mystery. And that's what I've devoted my life to doing. And Jack has also done that. And David, obviously, in writing a book like this, sees the importance of, let's say, rejuvenating physics from the sit down, shut up, and calculate kind of stupidity, which seems to run rampant in the heads of very bright physicists who become kind of idiosyncratic moronics with respect to anything having to do with anything which goes outside of the limit of their own type of calculation. And it's unfortunate, because what that leads to is a division, a cutting off, a cellular activity in which one cell has no idea of what the other cell is doing. So there are only a few physicists who, you know, maybe like myself and Jack and obviously David and Richard Feynman and some others that I could mention, who had this interest in not only spreading the word, but spreading the passion.
Jack, you've been known to go against the grain. I think you take delight in tweaking the noses of some of your more rigid colleagues. Were you thinking in those terms back then that, hey, this is what a scientist is supposed to do? Look at the big picture, be open to all kinds of ideas, and not be so rigid and limited in your worldview?
Yes, absolutely. And also, you know, I was kind of in that tradition. Phil Morrison was one of my teachers at Cornell. And he was like a Renaissance man, and he instilled that bigger vision. He was a student of Oppenheimer's, and you know, goes way back to the founders of quantum theory. And also, I was influenced by John Wheeler, not only by reading his papers, but Wheeler came to La Jolla, University of California in San Diego, in La Jolla, quite frequently, and you know, we had sort of intimate contacts with him. And also, I was with Wheeler in 1967 at the Max Planck Institute in Munich with Werner Heisenberg. And there was still, you know, I mean, I was also exposed to European intellectuals, especially at Cornell, and that whole kind of intellectual European tradition that actually David talks about, I think, somewhat in his book.
We'll bring David back in a second. I want to get your personal stories, how you were drawn to the group. Fred, in the book, it says that, you know, it describes your employment history. I mean, you were as mainstream as it gets. I think you were working on nuclear weapons programs at the time and teaching.
Yes.
And then you had students that came to you with their stories, consciousness, paranormal type stories, and you did the unthinkable. You listened to them.
Unfortunately, I did. I was a full professor. I was fully tenured. I had Air Force grants. I was doing research and was publishing papers in ion molecule reaction theories, which is necessary to understand what happens in the upper atmosphere after a nuclear burst. And that was where the Air Force was willing to spend a lot of research money. And I was doing some pretty basic research using quantum physical ideas set to do these calculations. That can take me into a lot of different stories, but just to make it clear, I got fed up with it all. I literally walked away from a full tenured professorship, and because my heart and my soul was inflamed. And actually, I blame Jack for this, because Jack was always the kind of a guy that would come up with these wonderful, crazy ideas that I found infections. So in a certain sense, when Jack would go in a certain direction, I started kind of following along. I mean, Jack was really kind of the leader in all this, as far as I can say. And so I really, in a sense, quit my job. Jack was at San Diego State with me at the time, and he left because of reasons that maybe he'll explain to you, but maybe some difficulties he had with teaching physics to dummies or working with the environment there. I don't know. But by the time that after Jack left, after about a year or so, I just got fed up, and I literally walked away from my tenureship. And when I did that, the people in the department thought, you are crazy. you can't, what are you going to do for a living? And I said, I don't know, but I want to pursue whatever it is. And that brought me into Berkeley and the Physics Consciousness Research Group and meeting all these weird characters like Werner Erhard and shamans, Kabbalist masters in Paris. My life became an adventure, which I still marvel at, and I'm very thankful that, in a way, Jack's influence was very strong on me, because I think that's what got me going.
I am in my head. I have. Go ahead. In my head, Jack, I have sort of an image of Ken Kesey and the Merry Pranksters, and I guess you're in the Kesey role of this thing, leading them and down the path.
You know, let me tell you a funny story. When I lived in La Jolla, I lived on Bonaire Street, Wind and Surf Beach, and Kesey's truck was parked in front of my house with the Merry Pranksters. But yeah, there are some interesting synchronicities about that.
How do you end up at the group? Because you were teaching as well. I think you and Fred ended up sharing a house together for a while. I can only imagine the adventures you had in that time period. But
it was like the odd couple with me as Walter Matthau, Fred as Jack Lemmon.
You had, Jack, you've talked about it before. You had an experience early in your life that you eventually sort of blacked out of your memory, and then you joined the fundamental physics groups, and it kind of comes back to you.
Okay. Let's get the timeline straight. The fundamental physics group came later.
Right.
That came later because what we're talking about, like 1971, 72, and what happened was very weird. I think I told this story before that Fred's friend from high school, Bob Tobin, suddenly showed up in San Diego and started talking about Uri Geller. And that's when all the high strangeness, in the sense that Eric Davis talks about, you know, and like the Skinwalker Ranch stuff, a lot of high strangeness happened. That's where the CIA came in, and Fred and I were sent to Europe on these adventures, little knowing what was really the puppet masters manipulating the strings, so to speak. It was very strange, but it's in my book, Destiny Matrix, you know, that story. It's too complicated to get into now. I don't want to take the time.
Okay, but I mean, it was a memory that you had of an experience that basically could be, some would categorize as paranormal. But do you think that that's...
No, it wasn't paranormal. It was, has paranormal. I mean, I received phone calls saying it was a computer and bought a spaceship from the future. This is when I'm 11, 12 years old. And I wasn't imagining it, because my mother actually finally picked up the phone and heard the cold metallic voice and told him not to leave my son alone, you know, my Jewish mother. But the thing is, my grandfather worked with the Army. And at the time, I would go to my grandfather's job, which was at Army Quartermaster Corps in Lower Manhattan. And, I may have met Phil Corso there then. I was about 10, 11 years old. It was about 1950. And this may have been some kind of secret Army project to encourage kids to, you know, get into science and using the interest in UFOs. It could have been that. But the weird thing is that the because I was involved in a kind of X-Men super kid group at Columbia University in my high school days, and got full scholarship to Cornell. So, you know, one can sort of see it was a project sponsored partly by Sandia Corporation, or what became Sandia Corporation, and people from New Mexico used to come up and, you know, give us pep talks about being patriots and figuring out the paranormal and UFOs and, you know, studying our physics real hard, stuff like that. So, but the thing is this, the paranormal aspect of it was that they said I would be meeting the others in the group in 20 years, and that's exactly 1973, you know, when all the SRI stuff, and with Bob Tobin coming to San Diego, and then Uri Geller, and then meeting the people at SRI doing the remote viewing and sending us to Europe. I mean, there's so it's very strange, but it's what's called high strangeness period.
Well,
and that led
to
the fundamental physics. The fundamental physics group came after that.
Right. Okay. Understood. I think that there's an example of spooky action at a distance, if you want to take all that together. Dr. Kaiser, David Kaiser, help me set the stage for continuing this conversation. The importance of including philosophy in connection with physics. I mean, the heroes of this group that you profile in the book were people like Einstein, who looked at big picture stuff, and suddenly philosophy was removed from the equation, so to speak. Set the stage about the importance of including that in there.
Sure. Yeah. Again, that's one of the things that really had attracted me to learn more about the group is that, you know, there are styles. If you look back over time, there are different styles that seem to make most sense to a lot of people about how best to do physics or science more broadly. But it's not the same style. I mean, it's a moving target as you look backwards or in different time periods. So just as you say, in the period what we might call the kind of golden age for modern physics, the 1920s, 1930s, is now the height of understanding Einstein's relativity and the birth pangs of quantum theory. And it's when people like, you know, Einstein and Niels Bohr were staying up all night arguing with each other. I mean, in a very good-natured, friendly way, but they just wouldn't let things lie. And even when they agreed on all the equations, that was the starting point, not the ending point. They said, that's not enough. And both sides of these debates over quantum theory were equally passionate that that they had to make sense of it conceptually and even philosophically, and that often meant reading or trying to understand these equations in the light of great thinkers from the European Enlightenment, like Immanuel Kant. For others, like Erwin Schrödinger, right from the start, it meant trying to understand Eastern texts. He tried to teach himself Sanskrit to better understand Eastern religious texts. In the same notebook in which he was working out what we now call the Schrödinger equation, the bedrock of quantum theory, you see his other notes and marginalia about these sort of Eastern texts. It's amazing. It was one effort as far as he was concerned. You know, Wolfgang Pauli had a long, long relationship with Carl Jung, the psychoanalyst. Pauli kept his own private dream diary with 400 entries so that he could go over his dreams with Jung and wonder about things like the collective unconscious and the nature of time. So that's for that generation, that's what it meant to be a physicist. You had to learn to calculate and do very, very good hard mathematics, and you had to worry very deeply about the latest experiments and the clever ways of trying to measure things in the laboratory. But that didn't exhaust your activity. That was the starting point. And they really were explicitly philosophical. And then, as you rightly point out, by the years soon after World War II, especially in the U.S., but to some degree really everywhere, that style starts to kind of get to lose out. It gets pushed aside or eclipsed by this much more kind of straightforward, pragmatic turn, which again was often called, you know, the shut up and calculate mode. And I think, you know, Fred and Jack just now kind of captured that again in their memories. So that's what it meant to do physics. That's what was held up for praise. That's what you teach your students to do. That's how you rewrite the textbooks. It becomes the new normal. But that doesn't last forever either. And so what really grabbed me about this book or this time period was that you start seeing that fracture, that hold on the field doesn't last forever, and the sort of cracks in that system start to come up largely from, you know, as seen by folks like Fred, Jack, and their peers, that's not going to be enough. And in fact, that might not get us past some of the, you know, quandaries where the field was stuck. And so there's a kind of pendulum swing to bring some attention back to the kind of deeper metaphysical, you know, far-ranging philosophical thought. And these days, I think we have a bit of a mixture. I think physics, we might say, is sort of better balanced than before. We can argue, is it perfectly balanced? Maybe not. But it seems to have room again for at least some folks to be, you know, professional physicists with that as their job title, working in the mode that looks more like Einstein and Bohr, and in fact, looks more like what the folks were trying to do in the 70s.
It seems to me, the kind of topics we deal with on this program, that there is not a whole lot of flexibility among mainstream scientists, not even wanting to hear about this stuff. In some ways, it's almost like a religion, very rigid in its commandments. Fred, you have to run into that in your work, a lot of resentment for the kinds of topics that you give fair consideration to?
Well, what I run into is very curious. Physicists that read me during my early stages of writing, like Taking the Quantum Leap, which you mentioned is one of my books, those physicists have now grown up. And now they're working in as full, I mean, they were like high school kids or first year college kids when they first started reading that. So those kids, they're still my kids, they think of me as some kind of, you know, superhero or something. I don't know what, but certainly not in a derogatory way. It's the old school thinking. It's people that are maybe the same age as I, or who've been schooled in a certain way of thinking, who tend to poo-poo the kind of thing that I think about. Although I have appeared on PBS shows, Closer to Truth, with some very noted highfalutin physicists and talked about spirituality, the nature of God, and quantum physics. And at that time when I was doing that, people were maybe a little bit feeling funny about it. But then, of course, it only takes somebody like Stephen Hawking to write a book and mention the same things, and suddenly everybody thinks it's okay. And when Jack and I were first writing about time travel and going backwards and forwards in time back in the early 70s, suddenly in current theories of physics, this is pretty much discussed, and nobody thinks too much about it.
We're taking a break. We're talking with Dr. David Kaiser, Dr. Fred Allen Wolf, and Dr. Jack Sarfati about how the hippies saved physics. Deep Purple taking us into the break on Coast to Coast AM.